It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Buzz Ryland. He was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin with a BS degree in 1971. His career was in business management and sales, and he retired from Wisconsin in 2010, which was also the year he first attended this church. He has been married 38 years to his best friend, Muffy. He is currently on the Humanists of West Florida Board of Directors and a registered secular humanist celebrant and Florida Notary Public. So welcome to Buzz.
Good morning. I'm going to do the words of meditation right now, and before I do that, I want to introduce you to who wrote the words, and it's sort of connected to Stephen Hawking, which is a discussion afterwards. So I'm going to read from the Meditations for a Humanist, Ethics for a Secular Age. The writer of these is a fellow named A.C. Grayling, and if you've never heard of him, I'll give you a little background. He's a philosophy professor at the University of London. He actually had an office in the same building that Stephen Hawking did. And so A.C. Grayling is also an author of many, many books. Here's one that he wrote, and it's called The God Argument, The Case Against Religion for Humanism. And I think it would have been very, very interesting to sit in those offices with Hawking and Grayling to hear their discussions. Because as much as I love Hawking as a physicist, I love Grayling as a philosopher. And I'm sure the two of those had some tremendous, tremendous discussions. The other thing that Grayling did, because I almost think he's a type of a genius, is he wrote what's called the Good Book, and this is called the Humanist Bible. And what he did is almost something like Thomas Jefferson did. Jefferson took the Bible and he did some snipping and cutting and made his Jefferson Bible. And what Grayling did is he took a lot of parts of the book and he totally rewrote it and took out all of the religion or supernaturalism or mysticism out of it and just wrote the story. As in the first chapter, Genesis, it says, "In the garden stands a tree, in springtime it bears flowers, in the autumn fruit." And that's the beginning of this book. It basically tells the same story, but it tells it in a totally different way of looking at it. So that's Grayling, if you're interested. He's a tremendous author, a very good thinker. So here are the words from Book on Meditation, from the chapter called Reason. One of my friends out here this morning asked me about the title, Reason of Humanism, and thought maybe it should be four. Well, actually, it's both. I'm going to give the reason of humanism, eventually suggesting that's the reason for humanism, but we'll get there. So this is out of the section for Reason. Most science and philosophy is on the side of the argument which says that reason, despite its imperfections and fallibilities, provides a standard to which competing standpoints must submit themselves. Reason's champions are accordingly hostile to currently fashionable postmodernist views, which say that there are authorities more powerful than reason, such as race, tradition, nature, or supernatural entities. Human traits and values were once thought to be constants, but social and other forms of engineering have turned them into manipulable variables, with the result that we have lost premises from which to reason about aims and means. The power of technology offers us many choices and thus usurps the fixed starting points of old, so we are afloat and undecided as to the values and goals alike today. In such circumstances, siren voices grow louder. Let us, they say, believe in gods or potions or planetary configurations to find our way. Or in postmodernist newspeak, let us recognize that there are only discourses, each as valid as any other. It might be true that human experience is now more fragmented and beset by ironies than it once was, thereby undermining competence. But still, say the champions of reason, reason remains by far the best guide in the search for knowledge. So despite its failings and limitations, we must cling to it. There are many who reject this view outright, however. Western civilization is in crisis, they say, precisely because we believe in reason. We live in a thrall to a utopian ideal of a rational society first mooted by enlightenment. Thinkers in this 18th century contrary to the hopes of such as Voltaire, have not liberated humanity, but enslaved it to a bureaucratic corporatism which stumbles unconstrained by moral purpose from one disaster to another. The anti-rationalist argument goes something like this. Enlightenment philosophers sought to rescue people from the arbitrariness of royal or priestly powers and to replace it by the rule of reason. But their dream collapsed because of reason's own limitations. All that happened was an increase in the influence of technical elites. The world, in short, became the fiefdom of managers. Owners of capital do not control capital. Voters do not control politics. Everything is run by managers who alone know how to manipulate the structural complexities of society. And the managers' goals, profits, elections, victories, are not shaped by the morality. Finally, the muddle in the thinking of reason's critics appears when we examine their alternative. They offer us a list of virtues to put in reason's place. One such reads spirit, appetite, faith, emotion, intuition, will, experience. One immediately notes that all but the last, if ungoverned by reason, are exactly the stuff which fuels fanaticism and holy wars. Here lies the poverty of the anti-rationalist account. Words for meditation today on reason. And now we'll do a meditation song. I picked out three hymns today. They're all based on the humanities section of the hymnal. And this one, I like the song, but I just love the title. Oh, what a piece of work are we. So, let's hear you sing it. I want to thank you for inviting me to speak on humanism. There's a pretty good history of what I'm doing today, and I'll get to that as I give my talk. I understand you've had some speakers give their stories of what their religion is about, different religious people. I want to be clear that from the American Humanist Association's position, it's not a religion. We don't even consider ourselves a religion. The U.S. government does. The only way that is because in order for we to send celebrants into the prison system, they had to put us under that category. And I did spend a couple years visiting a prisoner over here in Blackwater River for a number of years. We also don't have ministers. Humanism doesn't send people off to university to get degrees and any basic story. We want people to understand the religious stories of the world so that they can help relate to that. So there aren't really any reverends of humanism. However, there are quite a few reverends that are humanists. For example, our own Bob Eddy was president of the Humanists of Colorado. I first would like to try to set up a little bit of a way of understanding how humanists feel. We have our logo, the Happy Humanist, on the front. We call it the Happy Humanist. Basically, we're happy with ourselves and what we think. That doesn't mean that we're happy with all of humanity. And to give an example of that, there's a sitcom show called The Last Man Standing. Has anybody watched that show? For those of you that don't know it, it's Tim Allen who plays a man named Mike Baxter, who's actually the general manager of a chain of, like Cabela's store, but they call it the Outdoor Man. He's in Denver. They're in Colorado. And he's the last man standing because his wife and they have three daughters. So it's the four women and Mike. And the four women are pretty much more liberal. And one day they were bantering back and forth, and Mike gives political zingers all the time, primarily towards the liberals and the Dems and stuff like that. And they're pretty gentle, but they're shots. And so we're watching this one night. The ladies were trying to get on him about why do you have such hate for all these other people, these different groups? And Mike came back and said, "I don't hate people differently. I hate people equally. I'm a humanist." So, and that made me laugh. And the truth of that statement is that we are about equality. I mean, we are all about equality, and I'll mention that a little bit later. But we're not about hate. We also probably aren't just about love. Most of humanists, if you talk to them, will tell you that basically we're frustrated with people all the time, even ourselves. You just look what's going on in society, what's going on in politics, what's going on in the world. It's pretty frustrating. So all these different groups are trying to solve some of these problems, and we humanists are trying to work to help those too. So basically, if anything, we're probably a group of frustrated people. So my talk is on the reason of humanism from the Dark Ages to the present. And actually, to give you a little history, I'm even going to go back farther than the Dark Ages. I'm going to read and paraphrase from an article that was written by Lyle Simpson, who is a past American Humanist president. And it's got some history in it, which I think you'll find interesting. About 2,300 years ago, the oldest recorded description of the philosophy of life called humanism was first articulated by the Greek philosopher Epicurus. He lived from 341 till about 270 BCE. His philosophy, which subsequent theistic philosophers relabeled as hedonism, centered on each of us maximizing our life here on earth instead of our life being regulated by the gods. His teaching was spelled out in detail in a poem written by a Roman named Lucretius. He lived from 99 to about 55 BCE. His poem was Delirium Naturum, which is on the nature of things. That poem was lost for a long, long time. And I'm going to mention a book to you that I recommend if you're interested in this subject is to read it. This is a true story. It's written by Stephen Greenblatt, the John Cogan University Professor of the Humanities at Harvard. It won the National Book Award winner. It won the Pulitzer Prize, I believe, in 2014. And it's called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. And it's really the story of Poggio Bracciolini. Poggio was basically not even paid secretary to the Pope back in that day, and he decided he wanted to go off and search for this manuscript, this book on the nature of things written by Lucretius. He found it in a monastery, and this is in the 1400s, early 1400s. Well, what's happening also is the printing press. And so as he was able to translate this and get it into print, it got out into the world all around Europe, and it was then discovered by the Medici family of Florence, Lorenzo de' Medici. And when the Medici family found it, they decided this was a pretty good philosophy of life, and they adopted Epicurus' philosophy for the whole region around Florence. And this is really the beginning of the Renaissance. So we went from before the story of Jesus to Epicurus, lost, you know, for 1,500, 1,600 years, basically suppressed. And the suppression was really done by the church because they did not want this story out on the nature of things. Same thing like Cicero's papers. Another pretty famous person who was considered a father of humanism was Francesco Petrarca. And he rediscovered Cicero's papers and got those published out. So during this time period, from Epicurus all the way up to the Poggio finding Lucretius's poem, there was this heavy suppression by the new religion, the Roman religion. It wasn't that people were trying to get information out and knowledge. One example was a writer named Giordano Bruno, and he wrote On the Infinite, the Universe, and the Worlds, and all that did was get him executed in 1600. So there was this long period of suppression, but here's where it begins to become interesting to today. The philosophy resurfaced 1,500 years later, and primarily by the work of Unitarian ministers in the early part of the 20th century. One of those ministers was Reverend Curtis W. Reese of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines, Iowa. Reese was intrigued enough with the concept that he considered giving a sermon to test his view on his congregation. He titled it A Democratic View of Religion, and he showed a copy of it, of the proposed sermon, to the Reverend John Dietrich, the minister of the Minneapolis Unitarian Church. Now, this is 1917, so over 100 years ago. Dietrich felt that the title was a bit too long and suggested a single word. Let's just call what you're talking about humanism. So that's when that word was first developed by these two Unitarian ministers. That made sense to Reese, and he delivered his sermon on the philosophy of humanism to the Des Moines congregation in 1917. Now, I think we'd all probably have enjoyed being in that congregation listening to what the comments were by people back in 1917. Like, what do you mean God has outlived his or her usefulness? Or, can you believe what our minister just said? I mean, I'm sure that was quite the thing back in the day. And I'll give you a little bit about what he did say in his sermon. From Reese, this is, quote, "The theocratic view of the world order is autocratic. The humanistic view is democratic. In the theocratic order, God is the autocrat, and under him are various minor autocrats called divinities, angels, spirits, fairies, demons, and the like. But in the democratic order, the people are the rulers of their own affairs, and above them are no autocrats, no supreme or minor whose favor they must curry. The humanistic or democratic view of the world order holds that the humanities in the world is largely depend on the human reaction of the world order that we like. The road traveled by the democratic religion is a scientific, not theological one." So he's calling it a democratic religion, but he's saying it's scientific, not theological. And again, this is 1917. Still going on with Reese's sermon. "This revolution in religion from theocracy to humanism, from autocracy to democracy, has been brewing a long time. For a long time, man has been gradually breaking away from the fate and the fatalism. The chief end of humanism, according to the democratic religion, is to promote human welfare here and now." So that was 1917. Then those two Unitarian ministers worked for 15 years to begin creating what they called the First Humanist Manifesto. 15 years later, 1933, they signed it along with another 32 other signatories. And then they went on, those two Unitarian ministers, to literally create, start, and begin the American Humanist Association, founded in 1941. So there's some history of how it got started, and it's UUs that did it. I want to talk a little bit about the Humanist Manifesto. There's been three of them, and we titled them A Humanist Manifesto, not The. And the reason we titled it A Humanist Manifesto is because there's going to be four of them or five of them. The whole concept is that it adapts, it changes. It's not the book that's written and it can't change anymore. And the reason for that is that they go back and they look to see what we've done as humanity over three or four decades, and then they make some adjustments, learning and moving forward. The first manifesto was signed, one of the notables was John Dewey. And they did try to use the word religion in it at that time. I can tell you that there's a pamphlet, and I think it's out here in one of the, where the pamphlets are. It says something about my humanist religion, and it's written by Sarah Olberg, Reverend Sarah Olberg. And that's a publication by the UUA. I so happen to have had debates with Sarah Olberg. Sarah belonged to the Milwaukee Unitarian Society that we both belong to. And we would sit there at times in classes after service and discuss back and forth this, whether or not it's a religion or not a religion. I know what she wanted it. She wanted it to be a religion. And then many of us said, no, we don't want it to be. We want it to be a philosophy. So that's still going on, that argument. Interesting enough about the first manifesto. It was written in 1933. That's the Great Depression. It's just at a height coming up. That sermon in 1917 is when the Bolsheviks were taking control. So what happened was those first humanists back in there got some labels thrown at them. Obviously, some labels at them. And one of the problems was that they also wanted, in that first manifesto, they talked about, and if I can find my note here, I probably can't. Non-profit. So they were talking about capitalism back in the, of course, it was Depression. So they've since kind of filtered that out because it really irritated a certain group of people. So some of that has been rewritten, and that's why manifestos get redone. The American Humanist Association is totally a democratic nonprofit organization. It's supported in this country by about 150 chapters, of which the Humanists of West Florida is one of them. Humanism's around the world. I mean, there are chapters and organizations in Europe and in other parts of the country of the world. To give an example of when the last manifesto was written, that was 2003. And I don't expect one now for maybe another 10 or 15 years or so. But it was signed in 2003 by 21 Nobel laureates. So when they get together to argue and discuss and now we're going to change or modify, they really get a lot of people in academia together and work through it. I'll just stop for a moment and say this. Because we're about equality, one of the major things in the manifesto, talking about liberties and freedoms and rights and choices, is that men and women are equal. Women have just all the power they should have to their minds and their bodies. We're having a problem with that in this country, but humanism stands with the women as equal to men. So we're pro-life in that sense, but we're pro-life's choices. And pro-life's choices is an interesting phrase because we mean from the beginning of life to the end of life. So being born and dying, those are choices that a human being has an inalienable right of their own to make. You can read the manifesto. You can Google it and go find it. And there's also really a lot of good humanist stuff on YouTube if you ever want to just go listen to other people give talks on it. So that's humanism from 2,300 years ago to today, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about today. In your order of service is our affirmations of principles. And this is pretty much a pretty condensed version of what we think and believe, and you're welcome to take those home and out front. On the table, right in the center of the foyer out there, are two pamphlets. One is, what does it mean to be a humanist? This is pretty simple, a very simple little explanations, gives you some good things to understand on that. And in the back of it are some pretty famous people, including Stephen Hawking, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who've given their names to that. And this pamphlet is our local one. It's a pretty nice pamphlet. This is the Humanists of West Florida. And for those that wonder how we got our name, it's not just because of the university here. We actually named ourselves after a historical map of West Florida. That's when the Spanish and the British were controlling this area. The Spanish named Florida. They had East Florida and West Florida. And so it goes from basically the Apalachicola almost over to the Mississippi. And we say that our chapter covers from Biloxi to Panama City, which it does right now. So that's how we got our name. I was also asked by a friend when I was going to giving this talk about why am I a humanist, and I'll get into some of that in a little bit. The answer primarily for me is in the manifesto and in these affirmations. But for many years, I can say that I'd been searching. I was raised Methodist, so I had a Methodist mind framing of the worldview. And when I went to university, I came out of university thinking, I'm not sure if I believe all that anymore, and I wanted to search for something differently. But my search really went on for quite a while, a couple decades, until finally one day, Muffy and I attended the Unitarian Universalist Society of Milwaukee, which is a very large congregation, 1843. It's one of the old Unitarian congregations in the country. Big church, 700 members, multiple ministers. But their senior pastor, Reverend Drew Kennedy, was Buddhist, and he did kind of what you're doing. He would speak in all the religions, sometimes for a series. He might speak for like 5-6 weeks and different ones every week, and they were very, very interesting. But when he did speak on humanism, my search, I decided, was over. I was hooked. I liked it, and I started to seek that out. And so, jumping to today, it was humanism that basically incorporated by UUs that got me into this. And so now I'm going to jump ahead to just 7 or 8 years ago, 2012, out in the foyer, out in the front, I was in a conversation with another member, and we decided we would look into starting a chapter. And so the Humanist of West Florida was started right out there. And it took us about a year. We got 5 more members on a task force. And the work to do it was not easy. I mean, we worked multiple times every month. And after a year, in 2013, we submitted our bylaws, had to write our bylaws, submitted them to the National in Washington, D.C., and was approved in January of 2013 as what they call a chartered chapter. And there were 7 of us. By 2014, we were close to 50 members. And today, the Humanists of West Florida is at 110. We're really happy with our growth. It's not been easy. We sometimes finding a place to meet is not always easy. Also, just to give you an example of followers, on our Facebook public Facebook closed page, we have 200 people, that over 200, and in our public Facebook page, there are 600 people following us already. So it's a growing movement, and we are part. The Humanists of West Florida also created the Gulf Coast Coalition of Reason, which is 15 secular organizations across the Gulf Coast. And we also are the supporters financially of what's called Meetup. We have a Meetup site called the Gulf Coast Free Thinkers, and there are 722 people on that Meetup site. So as a result of me getting started in the chapter, I became also a registered celebrant. That's what the humanists basically call the people that try to do the ceremonies of life that ministers will do in the religions. And I also became a notary public, so that way I've done weddings, a number of weddings, and I can notarize them and do that. The other thing, one of the things I did do that I'm pretty proud of, and I like to tell the story, is one of the people that became a part of our task force, before that happened, contacted me as a celebrant to do his retirement ceremony. And the retirement ceremony was of Dr. and Captain J.R. Heil of the U.S. Navy, who was the head of the medical unit at the Naval Air Station. He did not want a invocation or a benediction. He wanted opening and closing words. And I did that ceremony with him at the Naval Air Station, under the hanging blue angels, up in the stage, all the naval brass up there in their white, the naval brass band from New Orleans. I mean, it's one of the memories I'll never, ever forget. Quite an honor to have done that. So I got myself into humanism and made it my current purpose in life in a big way, as you can see, and it all got basically started by UUs and right here. So what I want to do for a moment now is to give you a little bit of background about, but before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about how difficult it is for humanism to grow. Even with social media, there is so much out there for people today, the younger people especially, there's so much for them to be aware of, that to get the message out is not always easy. But yet we're trying to do that, and the reason for doing that is because the latest poll about religious people in the United States had the biggest number in that questioning group be the nuns. 23% nun, 22% Catholic, 21% Protestant, with the nuns. And they're saying no religion. So one of the things when I was looking at to be a humanist was I'd said to myself years ago that I I felt I was no longer a theist, and I would be called atheist by the theists. But I thought, now what? Do I just stop there? I mean, is that it? So that's part of the reason for the humanist chapter and being an activist is to find a way to do something with that. And with these nuns deciding to not be connected to religion, there's still a way to, we hope, to build community where they can come together, where they can do service projects in the community, where they can help people, where they can find people perhaps that are like a little bit more like-minded in their thinking in that way. So that's one of the goals that we're really working on today. We all know that the www out there isn't all truth, absolutely. But the one good thing about the social media today is that it can knock down the BS a lot quicker than it took 1,000 years back then. It took a long time to correct stuff that got wrongly done. Today we can do that a little quicker. So humanism, for me, is not always easy. And some people will look at it and say, well, it is too easy. There's no higher power. There's nothing you have to answer to. There's, all you have is maybe your principles and that's it. That's pretty easy. But that's not true. That makes it tough because none of us are perfect. And we try to follow these and do the best we can. And so we're tested every day at it. I'm self-criticize myself a lot. Our ethics and our principles make it harder to get through those morals and ethical dilemmas that we sometimes have. We believe that there's a way of proclaiming our moral compass, though, that without a higher power, we sort of self-guide each other. And that's where we put our faith. We put our faith in each other. And that's not easy because we let each other down regularly. It's just the human, it's just natural human being. I've told my doctor that my faith is in you. So that gives you an idea of somewhat how I think. I've given you some information and handouts, but I would like to tell you a little bit about what we do here locally, just so that you can get a feel for it. We're proud of our board of directors. I'm just going to give you a little bit of we have 6 of them. I'm one of them. We have a retired professional healthcare and worker and technical writer. We have a retired Escambia County School District guidance counseling director. We have a retired professional musician for the Indianapolis Symphony. We have a current general manager of a wind turbine and solar company that travels the world because they manufacture cabling for solar and wind on our board of directors, and we have our current president is a attorney for the Guardian Ad Litem. So it's a pretty good board of directors. A couple of things that we've done in the last 5 years, just to give you an example, the simple things we've done is we've packed hygiene packs for the homeless and given out hundreds of those. We've cleaned up a highway for a couple years out here in 9 Mile Road. But here's an interesting number. Our group of people with their own money and funds has purchased and distributed over 50,000 pounds of food. That's 25 tons of food to the poor in the area. We've done it in Escambia County and in Santa Rosa County. And we've done it in connection with the United Way, and we've done it where we've just gone in to the federal housing projects, let's say here in Pensacola, and set up and brought in food and distributed it. So that's something we try to do every year is one of those food distributions. And we're up to about 25 tons. We help the Washburn Center, which is the homeless place, the St. Vincent de Paul. Last fall, around Thanksgiving, we collected over 100 pair of shoes and socks for the homeless people. We support and strongly help Satoshi Forest, which is owned by Sean's Outpost. Satoshi Forest was in a big fight with the county for 3 years because the backyard people didn't want the homeless people on the other side of the fence. Satoshi Forest won that argument with the county, but they had to do certain things to be legal. And one of the things was they had to have fire extinguishers there. County doesn't realize that most homeless people at tent have some sort of fire extinguisher, but We had to put them. So what we did is the Humanists of West Florida, we acquired 6 fire extinguishers, 6 housings, 6 posts, and we erected those last month all around the campsites so that they could comply with the county's ordinance. We've built raised bed gardens for the homeless out at Satoshi Forest. We helped them plant gardens when we're out there. Another thing that some of you might know, you might not, we've been a big supporter from day one from the Navigators program, which is right here in the, I think they're in Gulf Breeze. But the Humanists of West Florida gives us money to help go towards paying for their liabilities insurance and things like that so that they can, their monies can go to help do projects for the kids. And finally, I'll tell you that what we're working on right now is a huge dream, but we're working on a project called Camp Quest. Camp Quest is, anybody know what Camp Quest is? Anyone? We got one. Camp Quest was created by the American Humanist Association in Washington about 15, 17 years ago. There are currently about 15 Camp Quests around the United States. They are summer camps where they're all-inclusive summer camps. Boys and girls go together from 8 to 17 years old. They have different times during the summer where they can go for a week. It's basically all STEM, some art, a lot of nature. The nearest one to us is in Smoky Mountains. And what we'd like to do is to have a Camp Quest on the Gulf Coast someday. But right now, our chapter's accumulated enough money that we want to send a kid to Camp Quest this summer. And we still haven't selected the child yet. The camp is the last week of July, the first week of August. If anybody knows of a youngster that would like to go, just get in touch with me. They have to write a short little paragraph of why they want to go to camp. And so we're working on that right now. Our hope is that we may, within a year or two, bring just like a weekend Camp Quest here to get something started. But that's what we're working on now. So in summary, 2,300 years back, here we are to today. I kind of have a phrase about some of the stuff that's going on in our society that bothers me, and I've kind of labeled it the dark state from the dark ages. So you've all probably heard of the deep state. That's some sort of imaginary thing that's going on inside the government that people are paranoid about at a certain level. I don't know if it even exists, but I think the dark state exists out there because there's some really dark, regressive things going on. And that makes it hard to be a happy humanist when there's so much frustrating things going on in the world. And it seems to me that part of the problem is a lot of people and a lot of organizations are still living in the past, and we need to jump to today and look at our problems and move ahead into the future and solve them, because nothing else is going to do it but us. We're either going to ruin this planet, ruin our lives, or we're going to make it better. That's part of the challenge of the humanists, and it's not a small one. And finally, so for the reason of humanism, I think the history that I gave you gives you the reason of it. The reason for it is we believe we need to do these things, things I just mentioned. We need to work hard to improve humanity even better. And not that it's not. I mean, we're getting better and better all the time, but we've still got some work to do. So for me, the question of why am I a humanist, and I basically say, why not? Why not be a humanist? So finally, again, it's a challenge. It's a struggle to be good. It's a struggle to do good. But it's all about a quote, and this is a quote from a movie that I really liked. Good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Thank you, and have a good day.